Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com.
I'm Mike Colomeco from Food Talk. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live from the Heritage Radio Network on Roberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick, Brooklyn, every Tuesday from roughly 12 to roughly 12:45, a little bit late today, kind of as normal. Joined in the studio with Nastasha the Hammer Lopez. How you doing, Stas?
Good.
Good. And who do we got there in the engineering? We got Jack.
And Evan.
Hey, Evan. Yeah, I rushed in so quickly because I was late that a lot of, you know what, the weather must be changing because I saw a lot of signs of illicit love on the streets walking over here in Bushwick.
Do you miss
the overnight detritus on the streets of Bushwick now that you've moved to Manhattan?
Moving back.
You're moving back to Bushwick?
No, Bed-Stuy.
Oh. I noticed that you didn't change your Twitter, whatever in the hell it's called, whatever in the hell
it still says Bushwick?
It still says Bushwick.
Yikes.
It's up slow.
But wait, what's illicit love in the streets?
Oh, well, I'm just assuming that if you have to throw your Spence away on the streets that you're not, you're not doing anything.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Gross!
Yeah, real gross.
Gross. Anything good going on, Nastasha?
Nope.
Anything bad going on?
Nope.
Yeah, nice. Well, nothing to report here. Okay. Call in your questions to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. Johnny Kirk wrote in, hey, Dave, he called, I guess, last week, Jack, and we just missed him. Sorry, just missed the opportunity to call into Cooking Issues today. My question is about curing bellies for bacon. What is your take on vacuum packaging pork bellies in a dry cure situation? Should I pull a full vacuum on a multi-vac style chamber machine? Do anaerobic conditions speed the osmosis and denaturation process? What are the pros and cons? And he gives you his cure mix here is 2 pounds of kosher salt, 16 ounces for that. So I guess two pounds kosher salt, 1 pound of brown sugar, and 2 ounces of sodium nitrite is his cure mix. Thanks for any advice. Okay. So look, The article that there's a couple of articles to look at. Okay, one, there's an interesting series of articles on Spanish, Iberico style and other Spanish cured hams, written by Barat, spanning the last name Barat. I don't know if it's a man or a woman, spanning from roughly 2002 to fairly recently, like 2010, 2011, on a technique where they directly thaw frozen ham. So a lot of these guys buy frozen product. I guess not for the really expensive stuff, but there's obviously an economic advantage to buying frozen product. For instance, you can do it any time of year, independent of slaughter. You can get equal weights of hams together, especially if you're like a lower quantity producer. You can store them until you have a batch of similar properties to cure together, et cetera, et cetera. And so there's a lot of testing of thawing in a brine as opposed to thawing in a fridge and then brining. The results, as usual, kind of mixed. But they also test vacuum pulsing. But the one I think you should look at, the article I think you should look at, is called Development of a Modified Dry Curing Process for Beef by Hayes. And this is sometime in the early 2000s. I think it's like 2004, 2005, something like that. I don't have the year written down. But what Hayes et al. tested was taking a beef, lean beef muscles to do dry cures on. This is another European study. And I think it's UK. And they tested normal dry curing, so salt. They tested salt in a vacuum bag. They tested salt tested salt in a vacuum tumble operation, and they tested – I shouldn't say vacuum bag. It's not vacuum bag. Vacuum tumble and tumble only. Now, the interesting thing is that all of the papers on this subject cite a bunch of literature saying that vacuum – the application of vacuum, or what they call pulsed vacuum, increases the rate of cure penetration or increases the speed. There's a couple things to look at. There's speed. There's also evenness. Right, of cure throughout the thing. So these, and also they test things like tenderness, drip loss, all this stuff. Anyway, so bunch of studies on this. However, these folks are focused primarily on pulse vacuum, and what that means is what what they expect to be the reason that things happen is that when you apply a vacuum, the meat expands for a variety of reasons. The moisture inside starts to vaporize and pushes it apart, and also any air trapped on the inside of the meat will start expanding and push apart any veins or any vessels, I should say, or any air gaps. Now, anyone that's used a vacuum machine knows that if you vacuum meat that's warm, it blows up just like a marshmallow does. I've seen fish rip themselves apart. I've seen steaks like inflate to 50% of their size, right? So then the theory being now that when you apply a vacuum like that and the meat expands to whatever degree it does, or the air inside expands to whatever degree it does, the insides of the meat are somehow more available to the outside. When the air comes back in and the pressure is reapplied, that the whatever is outside, right, the exogenous stuff, gets injected in. Now, these guys who are in the beef one are testing a dry cure, so not a brine. And I don't know whether or not their results – they showed not that great a result for in terms of increase in amount of salt reaching the interior, and by association also nitrites, because they're also very diffusible things. Trites, not trades. And the so they showed not that big of a difference, or not a lot of benefit to doing what they call vacuum pulse alone. However, they're using a dry thing, and my feeling is that maybe maybe in a wet cure application, it has more of an advantage. They showed that tumbling increases any sort of tumbling and vacuum tumbling increase substantially the rates of penetration and the evenness of the cure and whatnot. Now, my feeling is that what they're saying, their proposed mechanism for why the vacuum works, right? And the reason, by the way, that things – I said things expand, A, because they're probably – if the meat's not fully chilled, there's going to be moisture vaporization, because when you apply a vacuum to something, it decreases the boiling temperature. You get a lot of vaporization. You can boil water at room temperature in a vacuum. Anyone that has a vacuum machine knows this. Anyone that doesn't is always shocked. You're like, well, what do you mean boil water? Well, you reduce the pressure. As you reduce the pressure, it's easier for water molecules to flash off, to vaporize, and so they do, and so it boils at a lower temperature, and that can cause the expansion of the meat. Anyways, if the actual thing that's going on is that the real benefit of the penetration is only at the moment that the vacuum presses the stuff into it, then a vacuum pulse on a dry cured product is not going to have too much of an effect until a localized brine layer exists on the surface of the meat. Now, this is just speculation on my part, but my feeling is that until that liquid kind of forms in the dry cure scenario, you're not going to get that much of a benefit from the vacuum. But I myself actually have noticed quite a benefit in wet and semi-wet things, right? But as the article points out, most of the benefits, they're not done by scientific studies. They're done empirically, and that's kind of a way of saying that cooks and R&D folks at plants know how much vacuum to apply, and the fact that it increases the rate of curing it from an empirical standpoint, instead of from studies. They just know because they know. My feeling is maybe once it becomes a liquid that it's going to help a lot more. And another thing that's interesting that I hadn't thought about in the past is this. If it's the pulse that's important, most of the procedures that I saw that these folks were using were single-pulsed things. In other words, they're only pulsing the vacuum one time. They're sucking a vacuum, and just by the way, the protocols that they're sucking is a 90% vacuum. They're moving and I don't know whether or not that's for they think that's a better vacuum to suck versus what we normally suck in a chamber vacuum, which is much higher, 98, 99, 99.9. In other words, by the way, just so you know, like an old timer seller of vacuum tumblers I spoke to years ago, 7-8 years ago, I told him kind of the vacuums that we were applying in kitchens, and he's like, no. He's like, you need to apply much less vacuum. He said, again, probably not backed up with science from the empirical thing, that if you suck too strong a vacuum, that in his words, the pores close back up again. I at the time, I was like, I don't really understand what the hell – I really don't understand what the hell you're saying. And to this day, I still don't really understand what the hell he's saying. But it made sense to him. And what he's really trying to say is, regardless of any studies, he finds that vacuum tumbling works best at not intense vacuum levels, like in on the order of 90% of the air being removed, right? So 10% residual. And that is, in fact, what these studies all run at, a single pulse where they maintain 90% vacuum, so 10% air remaining. They maintain that for a period of time and then release back to atmosphere. But if it's the pulsing that does it, why just do it once? When we're doing vacuum infusion of fruits, right, we put it in the bag and then we suck a vacuum on it, bam, we infuse it, then we suck it, we leave it in the bag because you don't want to volatilize a lot of aroma off. Please, people, don't ruin your whatever. Anyway, so then you apply another vacuum to the bag, right, and as you do that, the bag expands. Why? Because I told you that water vapor is going to be formed as the pressure reduces. Water vapor forms. The bag inflates again. Then you can let the air back in. Bam! You can do it again and again and again. So why pulse just once, Stas? Why just pulse just once? She's like, not only do I not know, I really don't care. I really just don't give a crap. Anyway, but the... So that's my feeling. So maybe a multiple pulse situation. But go take a look at that article, and I'm still going to do a little more research to see whether I can figure out whether or not there is a benefit, or a lot of articles on the dry pulsed vacuum for dry versus pulsed vacuum for wet. But you specifically care about dry, so it's interesting, you know, for that standpoint. But I didn't get a chance, unfortunately, to go back and read the references. If you go to that paper that I mentioned, which is Development of Modified Dry Curing Process for Beef by Hayes, you can see that they have a bunch of references for people that do think that vacuuming helps quite a bit, and so you can check those out. I didn't have time, but I'll read you a little chunk of this article just so you have a flavor for the kind of crap I read for you people. The salt content, table 1, between the core and outer regions differed with a P of less than 0.001 for all treatments with the exception of the tumble-only treatment, which had similar salt content in the outer and core regions. This result indicated that for the tumble-only treatment, there was a more even distribution of cure ingredients in the meat. Comparing core regions only, the salt content for vacuum tumble and tumble-only treatments were found to be different to the control. Vacuum tumble and tumble-only treatments had the highest salt content for the core region of 3.3 and 3.1% compared to 2.1%. For the control. This result indicated the potential of vacuum tumbling and tumbling only treatments in accelerating the curing process, i.e. rate of diffusion of curing ingredients to the core of the muscle. So the, here you go. Vacuum is known to increase core absorption. Here's a paper you can look up. Solomon et al. From 1980, as well as extraction of salt-soluble proteins. Sharma, Kumar, Nana, and Kumar, two Kumars in one paper, 2002. This is interesting. You know, in Dax's class, right, he's in third grade now. I like Kumar and Kumar. That's my next band. Kumar and Kumar, 2002. He has two Sophia Lees in his class. And check this out. You ready for this? They go by, I'm not kidding here, Sophia Lee 1 and Sophia Lee 2. Who the hell wants to be Sophia Lee number 2, like player 2 all the time? It's not like they switch up. It's not like they're like, this week I'm Sophia Lee 1, and this time I'm Sophia Lee 2. And here's what you want to know, even more messed up, Stas? You ready for this? They're not the only two Sophias in the class. There's a Sophia, another Sophia in the class, so they can't even just go by Sophia 1 and Sophia 2, because there's a Sophia 3 if you just use the first name. I forget what the third Sophia's last name is. But that's a boatload of Sophias in one. I mean, it's not like Dax is in a class of 300 kids and there's like, you know, three Sophias and two of them miraculously, by the way, unrelated, happen to be Sophia Lee. You know, at least unrelated far back as Adam and Eve. Eve, more importantly, I guess. Well, who knows, man? Well, whatever. You know, Mike, you get my point. Not closely related. So what the hell? Did you know Sophia was such a popular name right now?
No.
Or whatever it is, 9 years ago, there was such a popular...
No.
I don't think I've ever known a Sophia. No. Have you? No?
No.
Yeah, maybe I have. I don't know. So anyway, where did that come from? Kumar and Kumar?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, God only knows what the hell's wrong with my brain. So anyway, so the vacuum tumbling, by the way, if you want to know the what's going on there, the theory is that the beating the crap out of the meat... not only speeds the penetration of the cure to the core, but actually like ridges around and creates more extractable protein, and that's part of what's going on there. So it also affects texture. So anyway, mildly interesting for people that find that sort of thing interesting, I guess. At Clefs wrote in, which I guess hopefully everyone that's listening, because that's the kind of crap we talk about all the time.
Yeah.
Stuff's like, I know. At Clefs wrote in, at Cooking Issues, what is the useful range in microliters for micropipettes when doing cocktail work? I know you've mentioned it before, but I can't find it. Okay, so there's a bunch of different – so micropipette, as I've said a billion times here, you know, in cocktail work, it's one of the few times when weighing by volume is what we do as opposed to by weight. I mean, kitchens almost always run on weight basis, you know, if you're normal. They run on weight basis measurements. But in you know, typically only water is the thing that translates easily back and forth between weight and volume. But in cocktail work, we almost exclusively work on a volume basis for a number of reasons. One, because the most important thing in a cocktail is where the wash line hits, where the actual drink hits in the side of the glass. You know, I judged a contest once, and the bartender who was doing the contest, and this is somewhere else, not in the U.S., and the bartender had radically different wash lines. So the two drinks that the guy poured were totally different in the glass. Like, one was higher and one was lower. And I was like, holy crap, the wash lines aren't the same. And the guy sitting next to me, who is also from, you know, not from here, was like, so what? You believe that?
I remember you telling me this a couple times.
Yeah, but because I still can't believe it. Mm-hmm. What would you feel like if you got the short glass and you know, your whoever you were out with drinking with got the tall glass?
They're not good.
Yeah, especially if it was champagne, am I right?
Mm-hmm.
If you got the short glass of champagne, and that happened to me the other day. I got the short glass of champagne. I was like, what? Especially when you pay by the glass, you don't want the short. How much do you hate it when you're paying by the glass and you get the short glass? You're like, oh, God. Yeah. And then you feel obliged to order another one just so you catch up because you know you're splitting the check. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, I don't know what the hell got me on that. So the wash lines are different. So that's why, like a lot of the things we do by volume. Also, it gets complicated with weights because the densities of our stuff is, you know, very different. And really what we care about is volume. Also, it's you know, inconvenient if you need to measure small volumes to do it by weight because you typically lose a lot. So what a micropipette does is it allows you to very accurately, very quickly, and very repeatably measure out small volumes of liquids. So where does this come up? One, it comes up in recipe development, especially when you're working with things that are small in quantity, so bitters, tinctures, salt solutions, sometimes acids, depending on what you do. But whenever you're doing centrifugation and you're using wine finding agents to be clarification aids, which is what, you know, we do. We typically use Pectinex Ultra SPL, which is almost completely dose insensitive. You can just splash it in by eye, and it doesn't matter as long as you don't add so much that it affects the flavor or the concentration or anything like this. It's really fairly dose insensitive. It's hard to OD on SPL unless you go crazy. SPL is the enzyme that I use to break down the cell wall of fruits and vegetables and olives and whatever. Cell everything. Breaks down pectin, breaks down hemicellulose, breaks down. I don't know. It has some cellulase activity as well. Not a lot. Doesn't do lignin. You know, anyway, whatever. So the so, you know, that one I don't necessarily need the micropipette for, although some people use it. What I use it for every day is kieselguhr salt and chitosan, because wine finding agents that work on electrostatic charge as their basis for function, right? They're causing the flocking, the agglomeration of opposite charged things, right? Those, if you overdose or underdose, it's useless. You've just ruined everything. So you really want to get an accurate, repeatable dose, and you're dealing with quantities like 2 milliliters, rather, per liter of product. And so you need something that can measure in that range. Now, there are different kinds of micropipettes and pipettes with various degrees of difficulty of use. The ones I use are auto pipetters that are adjustable. So you can, sometimes you get them and they're just a single range. And so you boop, 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 boop. You can only do one thing. The adjustable ones, and the ones I use are by Silogic. Silogic, I believe, is the name. Are pretty awesome. And you buy them in a range of things. So the one that I use, and they're specified in microliters, right? The one I use is 1,000 microliters, which is 1 milliliter, all the way up to 5,000 microliters, which is 5 milliliters. Now, I found that I very rarely need less than that, less than 1 mil per pop, and it's extremely accurate there. However, it says explicitly in the instructions to never turn the adjustment knob, and I think I paid under $100 for the one I have, or around there, never turn the adjustment knob past what they want because it's going to ruin the calibration, and also it gets less accurate because the way it works is there's a piston that's very finely graduated, and you push down until you feel the first stop. That pushes the piston down a measurable amount, and the amount that it's pushed down is dependent upon how you set it. There's a twist where it goes click, 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 and you set in exactly how much you want, and it's got one of those old school like speedometer click, click, click things, which is pretty awesome, or like a tally counter. You push down until you feel the first detente. You stick it into the liquid. You release on the knob. It sucks up what you want. You put it into the vessel you're going to push into. You go push down to the detente position, and then boom, past it, and it has an over travel that pushes out the extra so you don't have anything left, and that's how it gets very high accuracy. Anyways, they specifically say do not turn this sucker below 1 milliliter or over 5 milliliters. Now, I've never turned it over 5. I have – well, I shouldn't say I did. A bartender once cranked this sucker down to 0.5 milliliter, and I was like, oh, you've ruined it. And they didn't. I tested it. I turned it back up to where it was supposed to be, up to like 2 mils, and it was accurate. Boop, 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 and now it goes down to now it goes down to 0.5 milliliter, so it works. But that's the size I recommend. And if you need a different one, if you're doing very highly accurate work, you can also get one that does like – I think 200 microliters to 1,000, and that'll get almost everything you need. I very rarely use the second digit. I really care about milliliters and decimal milliliters, and so you know the last digit, I'm basically ignoring it. Yeah, because mine reads a single digit for the thousands, and then of microliters, then a tens digit for tenths for hundreds rather, and then another digit for tenths. It doesn't read the third digit. At least I don't think it does. I can't. In my head, it doesn't, and I don't really care if it does anyway. Yeah. Right? You want to take a break?
Sure.
Take a break. Come right back with cooking issues.
And this one's a song by my friend Herbert Spliffington.
Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit www.surreyfarms.com.
And, welcome back to the cooking issues. So, we had a note in from, and this it makes sense. Let me see here. At asquiddy.com, and the name they put is a cephalopod. But, you know, cephalopods, for those of you that, you know, aren't hip to your nomenclature, cephalopods, which means foothead, are the kind of most advanced mollusks in the world. So you got your squid. You got your, squids are awesome, right? You got your octopi, my personal favorites, by the way. The giant Pacific octopus, baller. Love the giant Pacific octopus. I've said many times, I will say it again. You got your chambered nautilus. You got your cuttlefish, master of camouflage. They're all really good at camouflage. They're like endlessly fascinating and for the most part delicious creatures. I've never had a nautilus. I don't really know what the hell it tastes like or anything. And they're kind of the most, you know, the nautilus are the most primitive kind because they still have their shell and they sit there like, you know, blah, 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 blah. You like nautiluses?
Mm-hmm.
Blah, 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 like kind of floating around in that weird shell that's upside down. But yeah, the trick is that so cephalopods, extraordinarily smart, but in a way that is very hard for us to get a grip on, because their sort of brain power developed entirely differently from, you know, it's entirely different from looking at the way our brain works, for instance, versus the way a dog's brain works, because we're, you know, infinitely closer related, right? You got to remember that, you know, we split off from mollusks, you know, back before the spinal cord was invented. You know what I'm saying? And so, you know, we're talking about these guys evolved from the same kind of crew that are like clams and things like this, right? So it's, you know, i.e., like almost all of them are big, big, dumb. You know what I mean? Like, I think very few of us have a problem thinking mechanistically about clams and muscles, whereas you should have a problem thinking mechanistically about the kind of brain functioning of, or the neural functioning, whatever you want to call it, of the an octopus. Anyway, and as I've said a zillion times before, and we'll say again, this time I'll actually get to it before I go off on a tangent. The problem with them is that they don't live very long at all. As a group, cephalopods are short-lived creatures. So even, you know, Arctuthis, or however you pronounce it, the giant squid that they've recently captured on camera, you know, you're talking something that is freaking big. A freaking big squid is only living for, you know, couple of years, like 5-6 years. You know what I mean? Like a giant Pacific octopus, I think it gets like 3 to 5 years out of its life. And then, because as soon as like the woman or whatever, you know, the female, as soon as she lays her eggs and they hatch, she goes senile and dies. And then and doesn't eat, by the way, the entire time that she's fanning her eggs there. And then the male, as soon as it does its business with the ladies, just starts wandering around on the floor of the ocean until it gets eaten apart, goes senile. So it's they're interesting. So in other words, like the only thing stopping them from either killing us and taking over the world, or else us you know, using them as you know, butlers in little aquariums that can like wheel around with joysticks, is the fact that they don't live very long. So you know, clearly at Squiddy, a cephalopod has an interest in this because of the Twitter name. But he says, or she, I don't know, because we don't know whether anyway.
We do have a caller. I just want to let the caller know we'll get to. We'll finish this.
All right, we'll get there. We'll get there right there. Okay, so he writes, lobsters feel pain or something. There's a Washington Post article out that just came out about it, and it details a lot of the research that's being done that I've mentioned a lot of times on pain and nociception, and what the difference between pain and nociception is. In other words, how can you measure that an animal feels pain versus just responds to noxious stimuli? And a lot of the work was done in hermit crabs and decapod crustaceans, which were completely unrelated to cephalopods, but the research is being extended into cephalopods, and it's an interesting thing to look at, so go take a look at that. Thanks to Esquiddy for that. Caller, you're on the air.
Yeah, I've got a question. Hi to everybody. I'm just a new listener, but I've got a question. I found some old corny kegs that a farmer had that were like 20 years old.
Right.
And some of them had, one of them was like 3/4 full of Mountain Dew. and it still held pressure and everything. And, I mean, I had to blow the pressure off. And so I tasted it, and it tasted like Mountain Dew. And I was, you know, wild hair, try to make just a little bit of wine out of this old Mountain Dew, right? So, but my yeast dies. So I was wondering if you knew of any way to remove sodium benzoate from a solution.
Yeah, so that's your problem right there, is that there is, yeah, no, I don't know of any way to unpoison the Mountain Dew. I mean, specifically, that's what they were worried about. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Like, so
sure.
They had a sugary product, and they knew yeast was going to grow in it, and so they put, you know, some preservative, probably at that time benzoate, into it. So I don't know of any way to thwart that. I can try to look it up, but I don't know.
I did look it up, and I saw that HCl will, but then that'll just make it inedible again, right? I mean,
Hydrochloric acid? Well,
yeah.
Wow, that's kind of, well, how much did they say to add?
Well, they didn't. That was kind of the problem. They said, you know, you can precipitate it out with HCl. It should turn to what, a salt, I guess, because it's already a salt. But
so you would get, so I mean,
I just don't know. I don't know that process. I just didn't know if maybe you would ever come across something like that.
So you're putting in HCl, so presumably you're getting NaCl, and then whatever hydrogen benzoate is, right? I don't even know what that is. Are they saying it turns into a gas and floats off? Are they saying it? What are they?
I have no clue because it was just on a couple homebrew websites, and they were like, you know, how do I get rid of sodium benzoate? And the guy just said HCl, and you know, it did nothing else. So
I don't even know what benzoate it is. You know what I mean? I don't know. Sure. I don't know the structure of it. So on the website they said that it precipitates out, huh? My guess is that the benzoate is something fairly large compared to normal things. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
But clearly it's soluble, you know.
Right. Right. Yeah, I just, you know, it was just one of those questions. I got the kegs last fall, and I worked with it a little bit with these little one-gallon batches, and it just nothing ever took off with it. So I knew what it was. It just was trying to see if I could get around that.
Well, look, if it's HCl, right? If HCl, there's two things that could be going on, right? It's an acid attack, or it's some sort of, like you say, some sort of precipitation is going on. You're somehow causing, you know, something benzoate to precipitate out. Although I don't know the chemistry of it, right?
Okay.
If it's an acid attack and you're just you know, destroying the sucker with acid, then you can just dope back NaOH, and you know, it'll have a saltier version of. And I've done that with stocks before. Now I had problems because I made soap, you know what I mean, with the fats that were in the stocks. But you know, you're not getting any problems with excess HCl on board, you know, if you have the ability to do that. But if it's a precipitation thing, I don't know. Someone has to know, or I can, you know, I have a bunch of old soda references from the 70s and 70s and 80s from the old AVI Tech series. Maybe they mentioned something about it, and I can try to do something. It's an interesting problem. It's an interesting problem. Try to get rid of the benzoate, huh?
Yeah, and you know, I don't even know that Mountain Dew wine would be that good. It was just a kind of a curious type thing, you know.
Well, how's it taste?
The Mountain Dew tastes fine. It just, you know, it just never started working.
Has it changed at all?
Not really. I mean, I couldn't tell that it changed at all. And the guy put it in there in like 1994 is when he got those kegs.
Dang.
I know. It blew my mind that they were still even holding pressure, that the O-rings hadn't gone.
Yeah, well, they're pretty good. I mean, they're pretty good. I would bet that you should change those O-rings.
Sure. No, yeah. That's already been done. But yeah, I just kept some of the stuff back. You know, I just siphoned it out and kept some of it out, you know.
Those corny kegs are great. You know what I mean?
Oh, they're awesome.
Yeah.
I bought 10 of them, and I mean they're just super.
Do you? How long ago did you buy them?
Last fall, like October.
Yeah, you know, like it's like been a couple of years now, but like, you know, 10 years ago when I was buying a lot of them, they were free. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
During the changeover from premix, and I think a lot depends on what part of the country you're in, because you know, the premix postmix happened at different times depending on, you know, obviously if your local water is really bad, you tended to stay with premix a lot of the time. But
right.
Or, you know, not bad, but not, you know, not tasting good, you know. So they're much more expensive than they used to be. It's crazy.
Well, I had heard something, this is just a little aside, that India still uses the corny kegs a whole lot, and that the demand over there was putting the price up.
Oh, really? Well, first of all, you know, all the home brewers are buying them.
Sure.
A lot of the cocktail folks who are doing kegging are buying them, and I guess, you know, they're being shipped over. But it got so bad that I think that they're making them again. So, in other words, like a lot of the ones that people are buying now aren't actually surplus, you know?
They're new.
Yeah, they're new.
You can still buy the new ones. I mean, they're a whole lot higher, you know. I think I paid like $20 a piece for these things, and, you know, I bought every one that I could.
Oh, yeah. And it used to be, you know, I shop for a lot of my soda gear at Mark Power in Guntersville, Alabama, and they used to have them like almost for nothing, just for the price of, and they would recondition them. I don't even know how the heck that they were able to sell them, but they stopped selling them a number of years ago. But they're awesome. I've never played around. A lot of chefs nowadays are buying, I think, the smaller ones. They're really expensive, the 3-gallon guys, because they're doing smaller batches and stuff. But yeah. Oh, I know what I wanted to ask. Was the color changed at all in the Mountain Dew?
Well, it changed a little bit, but not really. I mean, you know, not as much as you would think. And there's actually two kegs that I didn't clean yet, and they're about half full, but I don't know what they're full of. One has a tag for Pepsi, and it's premixed, which I didn't understand. I didn't understand why they would have kegged a premix, you know. and shipped it all over the place. You know, just 5 gallons worth of Pepsi.
Well, but, I mean, they probably. Oh, you mean why they shipped it to you that way instead of venting it?
Well, no. Well, why it didn't come as concentrate and then mixed into the water. But your comment earlier makes more sense that the water probably is not great and they wanted to control the water.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the. I mean, I never actually worked commercially with premix, but I think that a lot of the houses would show up with the kegs and swap them out. I don't know how much mixing was done in house, or you know what I'm saying. I think people would bring the 5 gallon charged stuff and then put it down. I had one more question for you about the Mountain Dew, but it's since left my head. Anyway, well, I'll try and look up for that. And if I can find anything, we'll talk about getting rid of Benzoit and making Mountain Dew wine. That's a hilarious idea. I have to say.
It's just a wild, you know, just came to me, you know. But yeah, I appreciate you answering my question. I love the show. I'm just trying to work through the backlog. So
cool.
Great.
Well, thanks for calling in. Talk to you soon.
Thanks much. Have a good day.
You too.
That was awesome.
Yeah. Right. Mountain Dew wine. I know what I meant to say. Like what's interesting is sugar sodas are fairly stable, but you guys ever – Stas doesn't ever drink diet soda, so she doesn't know. But if you have diet soda, the aspartame can break down into salts and it loses its sweetness. So if you've ever had even canned soda that's stored at extremely high temperatures, like you know, in a laundry room for a long time, like it can taste weird and salty. So, like, if you made the wine, it would be very – it would be weird because it would be – all the sugar would be gone. Man, interesting idea. Speaking of soda, Tony Harrion from Brazil
wrote – real quick, though, just to finish up the cephalopod stuff.
Yeah.
On the cephalopodpage.org, you can buy a crazy amount of cephalopods as a hobbyist.
You mean like different like octopus varieties and stuff?
Yeah,
they're rather difficult to keep. I think
it's crazy. Just this list is insane. Yeah, some of them say like deadly, not recommended, but apparently you can still buy it.
Well, one of the deadliest creatures on a weight basis is the blue ringed octopus. You know, and they're really pretty. I mean, like, look, they're freaking amazing. Like, you know, they change colors. I mean, they're awesome.
That's the one here. It says one of the most dangerous creatures on Earth.
Yeah, man. You know. It's like, but very rare to get stuck by, you know, or you know, hit with one of those. They first of all, they flash at you when they're pissed. You know what I mean? So it's not like you're shaking hands with a blue ring octopus and all of a sudden it zaps you. But you know, I've read a bunch of books on cephalopod behavior because I said like I like them, and all the researchers, all the octopus researchers. Will say that they definitely have a sense when you're dealing with them that they're dealing with an intelligence, right? That the cephalopod when it looks at you is actually looking at you and not just, you know, some sort of like dumb gaze. And they can perform amazing tasks, solving puzzles, doing things, reaching out of the tank, to get things, undoing jars to get inside of them, things like this. But what's strange is the stuff that they can't do. This is what, like, when you research them, it's amazing. Because they have such intense abilities in some ways, like they're like a lot of their neurons have to do with the coloring and texture of their skin. Their skin is much more highly tweaked than ours is, much more. But they don't have certain things that we would think are completely normal, like the ability to know exactly where their tentacle is in space. Because I guess they don't have a structure like we have, internal structure, and so they don't have the same proprioception things that we do. So things that we take for granted, they have very difficult abilities with. Things that we would never think that they could do, they can do with ease. So it's they're fascinating. Love myself some cephalopod. All right. So Tony Harrion wrote in from Brazil. Hello, Cooking Issues and the HRN team. By the way, this fits in nicely with the Mountain Dew because it's a question about soda and premix specifically. Hope everyone is doing well. I've got a question for Dave concerning two very beloved subjects of ours, soda and cocktails. I'm designing a cocktails on tap system and was wondering about the tap valves. Dave has mentioned a couple of times about the Ibis Tower / Becker, which is CM Becker, a corporation valve he uses for his soda system. That is true. They get it from Fox Equipment here in the U.S. That is what I was aiming for, to dispense the drinks, at least until I looked up the price tag for that tower. Almost $400 for the two-faucet tower and $350 for the single on Fox, two X's like Red Fox. Remember Red Fox? Remember Sanford and Son?
Mm-hmm.
One of the great theme songs of all time. All right, all right, all right. Fox, I'm being told that I can't talk about how awesome the Sanford and Son theme song is, even though that is an amazing theme song. FoxEquipment2X.com. Wow. That wow is about the price. In fact, my biggest surprise was how much you guys love your soda even more than I do. Or was it eBay Kung Fu? Your no duct tape New Year's resolution from a while back must be tremendously effective. Jokes aside, in my case, throw a 95% import tax and shipping to Brazil. You know that? Like, people in Brazil, when they order stuff from here, have to pay like double. Like, the tax is like some intense, intense stuff. I don't know how they're allowed to get away with that, because we don't tax the crap out of Brazilian stuff when it comes here, do we? I don't know. I don't know about it. I could almost buy 2,200 liters of outstanding bottled sparkling water around here. Instead, I was recommended the Perlick 545 PC flow control faucet for much less to help control foaming. You link a homebrew thing here, right? I assume from pictures and schematics that the compensator mechanism is pretty different from the two. Do you believe that the Perlick will fit well for cocktails dispensed from a corny keg system? Could the Ibis really do that much different for this application? And what alternatives could you recommend? My main concerns, as they should be, are excessive foaming and loss of carbonation. I appreciate your insights. Keep up the good work. Tony Harrion. Okay, here's the deal. The Ibis Tower with the Becker premix on it is expensive because they're taking a premix valve, a nice one, and they're retrofitting it onto a beer tower, and they're charging you an exorbitant rate, and it looks really nice. So you're paying for a lot of chrome. You're paying for the fact that nobody uses these damn things anymore. By the way, the tower is nice because it's got a chilling line in it as well to chill the tower, because it's, you know, similar to like a Cobra head, but it's called Ibis because it's thinner than the Cobra heads. Anyways. It's expensive because of all the chrome and because nobody wants it, right? The problem with soda is everybody knows that the soda guns, the ones that they use in post-mix, suck. We all know they suck, right? The Wonder Bar and all their variants. We all know that they totally rob you of carbonation, that in general they're not clean enough and they make horrible tasting stuff. Everybody knows this, right? But whenever anyone tries to go back to a single valve dispensing, because that's the way to do it, they always go to the beer-style valves, like the one that you recommend. And the problem is this. Beer is put through a much lower pressure than any of the stuff we're dealing with because it has a lower alcohol content than cocktails do, and it also has less carbonation than either soda does or that cocktails do. So you're never going to get good results out of a beer system with you're never going to get very highly carbonated results without foaming out of a beer system. The only choice you have is to get a pre-mixed soda thing, because they are designed to compensate much larger pressure differences than you can get can be compensated through a beer style valve. The good news for you is you don't have to buy the expensive stuff if you don't need the tower. You can go to CM Becker. That's Charles Mary Becker is the corporation. And by the way, the people who pick up the phone there don't know a freaking thing about it, because they happen to make these things. They don't care about it because it's not really good business anymore. But you can go on their website and look up premix valves. And the standard wall mount valves that can be mounted on a piece of stainless steel, right, and they just have a hose attachment on the back, and you take it down to like a quarter or 3/8 hose and put it through your cold plate. Those things will work just as well as the fancy one that I have. They just don't look nice coming out of a deck mounted application. For my home application, I required that A, it looked nice because my wife's an architect, B, I'm not using duct tape anymore, remember, and C, I couldn't wall mount like I had before. I needed to deck mount it, and so to have all of that, I needed to go with that expensive system. If you can wall mount, you can get the much less expensive, on the order of, I think they're like $30 maybe, for one of these premix valves, and just mount it into the wall, and you can get 2, 3, 4 of them and line them up, and they work great. The other thing that you need to realize with cocktails foam a lot more than soda does, a lot more. And it's because alcohol has a lower surface tension than water does, and also it has a higher viscosity. So you're dealing with a higher viscosity to hold bubbles and a lower surface tension, which increases the rate of bubble formation in the liquid, and what you have, therefore, is a nightmare. Also, you have typically, for a given level of carbonation, a feeling in your mouth, more CO2 in alcoholic products, and cocktails are more alcoholic than beer and then a lot of wines, and so therefore therefore you have excess foaming as well. Couple that with the fact that you can never get stuff that cold with a cold plate because you're only going down to ice temperatures, and I'm typically serving a good 5-6 degrees below that when I'm serving cocktails. Problems. But to get around it, you want a very long flow so that as something comes out of your keg system, it has a long time to calm down before it comes through the compensator and out of the tap, right? And you're not getting as much pressure because you get a pressure bigger pressure drop along a long line. But also you're going to want to run through two channels of your cold plate, not one, two channels of your cold plate, so that it has a longer time, it can get colder, and it's a lot colder, a good 5 degrees colder typically, if you run through two versus through one. Running through more than two doesn't really give you an advantage. Another thing you might want to take a look at, if you're only running cocktail through it and not regular liquids, is using, and it's going to ruin anything but stainless, it'll ruin the aluminum that most cold plates is made out of eventually, but you could look at using a salt solution, eutectic solution, usually potassium chloride, something like this. Depending on the alcohol content you're running through, you might be able to get hyper cold stuff. If you calculate it wrong, you'll freeze your line solid, and you know it won't burst the at least it has never, when I've made mistakes, burst my cold plate, but it does suck, and then you have to thaw out the cold plate to get it to work. So anyways, because we have to get off, right? Well, anyway, so hopefully that gave you some information. Next week, I was going to get to Kenji had written on the Twitter about shrimp and baking soda. Maybe we'll have time to talk about that next week.
One more question.
Oh, yeah, what's that?
Because me and Nastasia were talking about this before the show. We were admiring some of the thinly sliced potato chips on somebody's plate that was eating at Roberta's, and we're wondering what your preferences are on potato chips.
I like thicker. Like
there you go.
My favorite.
She was right. She said Dave's not gonna like those.
I know. Look, I appreciate any well-made product. So like a thin potato chip that's nicely made, I enjoy. But just for comparison, my favorite potato chips that I've ever had ever are the actual original Maui ones that they've never shipped off the island. That like when people go to Hawaii and they bring them back in bags. Now, granted, I first had these like 20 years ago, so I don't know whether or not I would still think they're the best things on earth, but my memory of those thick, like, you know, Maui kettle cooked thick potato chips was that they were kind of God's gift to potato chip world, at least at that time of what things I've had. I prefer a thick normal to a Ridgie's, although I like the fact that a poorly done Ridgie is better than a poorly done thin chip. You agree with me on this one?
I'll agree with you there.
Yeah. I think a thin chip is hard to do, so a really good thin chip is probably a thing of beauty. Oh, and by the way, next week I hope to have time to discuss Travis Hawkins from last week's actual question, which is pet peeves and faux pas in the kitchen. So tweet on in to @cookingissues or to the Heritage Radio Network for next week's show your favorite kitchen faux pas, and we will talk to them, for instance, using someone's knife without permission, and we will talk about them on next week's Cooking Issues.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.